We admire the men and women of the Bergrettung. They're mostly men, certainly in Austria, by the way, about 94%. But why? What can we learn from this institution for how to live?
Herzlich willkommen zum Podcast Nebelhorn, The Scientist for Future Hamburg. Heute werden wir mit Marc Weiner sprechen. Marc ist aus den USA und wir werden heute unter anderem über den Begriff Heimat sprechen. Das Ganze geschieht aus der Perspektive des Heimatfilms Bergrettung und Marc hat vor, einen Film zu drehen über die Bergrettung und hat sich daher mit diesen Themen auch auseinandergesetzt. Hallo, Marc.
Hey there. Nice to hear you. Nice to see you here on this podcast link. Greetings from the United States. I understand that you're in Hamburg.
Ja, ich werde kurz ein bisschen auf Deutsch anfangen und dann sprechen wir Englisch weiter.
Ja, das geht auch.
Marc, hast du gewusst, dass Hamburg über 20.000 Mitglieder hat beim Alpenverein?
Nee, 20.000? Gibt es eigentlich Bergen in der Nähe von Hamburg?
Ja, es gibt die...
Die schöne Lüneburger Heide ist nicht weit weg.
Stimmt, ja. Die Lüneburger Heide ist nicht weit weg. Und bei Harburg gibt es auch Hügel, die nennt man hier Berge.
Sagt die Österreicherin.
Okay, das darf ich nicht sagen. Ich glaube, das müssen wir rausschneiden.
Nein. Viele Grüße an all die Hamburger, die in der Alpenverein Mitglieder sind.
Okay, also in Harburg gibt es Berge, wo ich auch manchmal gern wandern gehe. Sie sind eher niedrig.
Ja.
Aber sehr spannend.
Und schön,
Also wie gesagt, Hamburg hat eine sehr starke Verbindung zu den Alpen. Es gibt hier Skiferien, also die einzige Stadt, die Skiferien hat.
Ehrlich?
Ja.
Aha, das wusste ich gar nicht.
Ja.
Ich weiß nicht, ob du weißt, aber ich war Austauschschüler 1983 in Göttingen.
Ich bin
da aufs Gymnasium gewesen.
Ja.
Deswegen kenne ich immer noch ein bisschen Deutsch.
Ja.
Aber ich erinnere mich gar nicht an die Skiferien in der Nähe von Hamburg. Das freut mich jetzt zu wissen. Endlich.
Ja, also in Göttingen gibt es die ja nicht. Die gibt es ja nur in Hamburg. Finde ich total spannend, dass Hamburg eben Skiferien hat und eben auch diesen engen Bezug, also 20.000 Mitglieder beim Alpenverein, das ist ja doch einiges, diesen engen Bezug zu den Alpen hat. Und darum dachte ich, dass diese Folge sehr spannend sein dürfte für viele Hamburger, obwohl ja du nicht in Hamburg bist, sondern dein Projekt in Salzburg angesiedelt ist. Also da komme ja ich ursprünglich her.
Ja.
Ich bin in den Alpen aufgewachsen und auch darum finde ich dein Projekt jetzt sehr spannend. Naja, ich werde dich kurz vorstellen, was du so gemacht hast, und dann machen wir auf Englisch weiter.
Okay.
Marc Weiner is a cultural historian, filmmaker and a teacher of constitutional law. He is the author of The Rule of the Clan, What an Ancient Form of Social Organization Reveals About the Future of Individual Freedom, published in 2013. He is the winner of the Grawemeyer Award for Ideas Improving World Order. The result of that award was the book Black Trials. Is that correct?
Yes, it's complicated. I've got this kind of very weird biography. Actually, Black Trials was my first book, kind of, in 2004. The Silver Gavel Award from the ABA, which I'm very proud of, is actually for Black Trials, which is a book about the history of African Americans and the law from the colonial era to the present. And then an earlier book, but it was published later, is called Americans Without Law, The Racial Boundaries of Citizenship. So a lot of my early work was about the cultural history of law in relation to questions of race and citizenship in the United States. And that book, you may see in the materials that you have, also is recognized.
So I think you have a very interesting and wide-ranging biography. I find that really fascinating. So
Thank you.
I miss something?
It's weird looking out over the course of scholarly career of a few decades. Yeah, you can pack a fair amount in there. There's another book called Laws Picture Books. It came out of a museum exhibition about illustrated law books from the Sachsenspiegel forward. co-authored with my co-curator, Mike Widener. And what else? Well, I've had a few opportunities to teach abroad as a Fulbright scholar in Iceland, in Sweden, and then, of course, in Austria. And I spent quite a bit of time lecturing in Germany as well, a country that I know and love.
Okay. And you also were Fulbright Distinguished Chair in American Studies in Uppsala, where you were a research fellow at the Miller Center for Community Protection and Resilience.
Yeah, it just sort of comes together. So in Sweden, I was the Fulbright Distinguished Chair in American Studies at Uppsala. There I taught an introduction to American politics and some constitutional law, and generally tried to engage in a lot of public outreach with Swedes about the American political tradition. And now I have an affiliation at the university where I used to teach, as you say, in German, I think, gerade war ich emeritiert an meiner Uni. And now I'm affiliated with something called the Miller Center for Community Protection and Resilience at Rutgers University, which is in New Jersey, which is just a little bit south of New York City, though I live and I'm speaking to you from Hamden, Connecticut, which is about 2 hours north of New York, right on the coast, where it's beautiful and snowing here in New England.
Snowing there as well, same here. So now you're working on a film and you raised over $100,000 from the Botstieber Institute for Austrian American Studies, the Reid Hoffman Foundation, and over 125 individual donors. So tell us about how you came up with the idea of making a movie, how your past training as a constitutional lawyer has influenced your idea, and what is your goal in doing this?
Happily. So I was teaching in beautiful Salzburg, Austria in 2015 as part of the Fulbright program. And I was teaching constitutional law. That was my primary area, and that's what I did as a professor in the United States. So I was teaching the American constitutional tradition to the students at Salzburg, largely Austrian. I was also at the time teaching a class on the history of American film, especially law in American film, because in addition to being a scholar and a writer, I'm also a filmmaker. And relatively recently, I guess about 5 years ago, I started a nonprofit video production company to try to bring kind of unusual, quirky ideas about law and society into some kind of cinematic form. So I was there in Salzburg. I was teaching constitutional law. And constitutional law gets one thinking about big ideas about how a society is organized. It's like the constitutional law is the organic foundation of a society and a social order. So I was in that frame of mind, and I was thinking, of course, also about Austrian constitutional law and the great Austrian legal theorist Hans Kelsen. And in the course of that research, I met, totally coincidentally, someone who was involved in the Austrian Mountain Rescue Service. And I was just captivated by what he did and the organization to which he belonged, this big national group, regionally organized with, it's something like 13,000 members across the country who go into the mountains and risk their lives to save people who have encountered potentially life-threatening emergencies in the mountains. And nearly all accidents in the mountains, as you know, are potentially life-threatening. So I was captivated with thinking about how the organization, the Austrian Mountain Rescue Service, Die Bergrettung in Austria, Bergwacht in Germany, could be a window onto society as a whole, to Austrian society as a whole. And then I started thinking about that even more. I went to the Botstieber Institute for Austrian American Studies, fantastic organization. I said, listen, I have this idea. I'm going to make a film about the Bergrettung from a kind of philosophical perspective. Can you help me? And by the way, the Austrian Bergrettung has had a profound influence on the development of mountain rescue in the United States. And this is something of great concern to the Botsdieber people. And they said, yeah, that sounds really interesting. We'll give you some seed money. And they did. They were sort of my angels. And from that seed money, I was able to raise money from other sources, including the Reid Hoffman Foundation, and even more from 125 individual donors in the United States, all of whom were really interested in what the experience of the Austrian Mountain Rescue Service could teach them in the United States more broadly about how society should be organized. Because my underlying idea in the film and in my scholarship, in my writing about the Berg Raton, is to understand the Mountain Rescue Service in philosophical terms as a kind of humanistic institution. That is, we can understand its medical practices in the mountains in the same way that we'd read Petrarch or some other classic text. And then further, to incorporate thinking about the Mountain Rescue Service as part of a larger democratic political theory about emergency medical services generally. That's a long response to your question. Maybe there's something to talk about here.
Yes, there's a lot to talk about here. So maybe first clarify the movie. There is a Heimatfilm series called Bergretter, plays a role in your approach. And you told me that it was originally called Bergwacht.
Oh, yes.
Started in 2009 and in 2012 to change the name to Bergretter. Maybe explain a little bit about that difference so people in Germany understand maybe the difference between the Bergwacht and the Bergrettung and maybe understand the historical development.
Yes, actually. So this television series, which is a wonderful television series, I just think it's fantastic. In its first seasons, it concerned Bergrettung organization in Ramsau am Dachstein, and the central character was a figure named Andreas Martaler. If you talk to some great Austrian philosophers who are going to appear in my film, by the way, one in particular will tell you that his two great heroes are Franz Schubert and Andreas Martaler. More on that in the film. In any case, this is a film about the mountain rescue organization in Ramsau am Dachstein. It's made by ZDF. Excellent series. It was one of the things that got me thinking about what we could learn from the Bergrettung and from the central importance that the Mountain Rescue Service has in Austrian national cultural consciousness. It was originally called the Bergwacht. That was the original name of the show. And unfortunately, while that's a name that fits perfectly with the German mountain rescue organization, which is called Bergwacht in the Red Cross, it doesn't fit in Austria. The Bergwacht is a German term. Essentially, we would call it a mountain guard. It's an organization that began in the 1920s and eventually incorporated under its jurisdiction not only all of those essentially police practices that are associated with the mountain guard, say the being the Blumenpolizei and preventing poaching and all sorts of other incursions or depredations on the land, but also it incorporated rescue activities. That incorporation of all rescue activities alongside all of the essentially, we would call them in a broad sense, police activities in the Bergwacht, which at the time in the early 20th century was part of the German Alpenverein, that incorporation can be understood as part of the Gleichschaltung under Nazism and under fascism, that is the coordination of all social activities under fascist control. After the war, the connection between the mountain guard activities and the rescue activities in the German Bergwacht, those remained unified, but not in Austria. Austria always undertook Rettung activities under the Bergrettungsdienst, not under the Bergwacht. But after the Anschluss, all of the Rettung activity of the Austrian Alpenverein was incorporated into the single now Bergwacht in the German Alpenverein. The independent Austrian Alpenverein was dissolved. All rescue activities occurred under the Bergwacht. After the war, when the Austrian Bergrettungsdienst reestablished its independence, not only from the German Bergrettungsdienst, the Bergwacht, but also independent of the Alpenverein, the Austrians immediately separated the mountain guard activities of the Bergwacht and the rescue activities of the Bergrettung. So in Austria, the Mountain Rescue Association is called the Bergrettung. It only rescues. In Germany, it's called Bergwacht. It rescues, but it also undertakes these other sort of police activities. Big division. So initially, this wonderful television series was called anachronistically Bergwacht to refer to the organization in Austria. And that is, in fact, totally incorrect. It made many Austrians upset, even though the television series is produced for ZDF, so it's perhaps understandable that it was called Bergwacht to prevent confusion. But I believe it was in season three, around 2012, that ZDF very wisely decided to change the name to Die Bergretter. Anyway, wonderful series, and the series really underscores the importance of mountain rescue activities to Austrian and more broadly German, Germanic cultural consciousness. Right? The people who appear in the show, like Andreas Marthaler, are heroes. We see them in heroic terms. And one of the interests that I have in studying the Bergrettung is to see if we can understand exactly what it is that the Bergrettung does, what makes it tick, in ways that have broader, more specific implications for democratic political theory. We admire the men and women of the Bergrettung. They're mostly men, certainly in Austria, by the way, about 94%. But why? What can we learn from this institution for how to live?
Mm-hmm. Maybe we should throw in here that you actually are also trained in wilderness rescue.
I am.
So I think that also influenced your thinking.
It did. So my wife and I spent a lot of time outdoors ourselves. We, of course, love the Austrian mountains and those in the United States. We've hiked all over the U.S., all over Europe. And at a certain point, I decided that it would be a wise thing to be trained in wilderness medicine in case anything ever went wrong. I began by taking just a very small first aid course. And the more I learned, the more I became interested in being a kind of theoretically oriented kind of person. Eventually, in the process of getting trained in these medical techniques and also in search and rescue techniques, I began thinking about their broader meaning. I can't just be trained technically. I also have to think about what does it mean? What does it mean for society? So eventually I became certified as what's called a wilderness emergency medical technician and also a front country emergency medical technician. And I've done some volunteering in that realm as well. And that actually is one of the things that brought me to Sweden in 2018, 2019, was to study the Swedish ambulance service and to ask some of the same kind of questions that I'm now asking about the Austrian Mountain Rescue Service about life and practices in the Swedish Ambulance Corps.
When did you find out that the American, I assume the wilderness training you did has historical roots in the Austrian Bergrettung? Is that how you termed it?
Yes, that's exactly right. I was very surprised myself. I had some general idea that the Austrians, of course, must have been influential on American mountain sports, but I didn't know how very direct the influence of Austria and Austrians and Germans on the development, not simply of mountain sports, but of mountain rescue in the United States was. And that came to me simply in the course of my research. I can give you an example, or actually the story itself. It is 1948. The Austrian service is now independent. It's the Bergrettung rather than the Bergwacht. And they hold an international gathering in the Wilde Kaiser Range in order to demonstrate the latest Austrian mountain rescue technology. The Austrians were always well advanced in technology of mountain rescue. That was, by the way, also in part a result of the war and some experiences that the German army had in Finland. In any case, there's a demonstration weekend, and the Alpenverein and the Bergrettung collaborate together to film it. And they make a film, which then is encountered in a bookstore by a Bavarian immigrant to Seattle, Washington, in the American Pacific Northwest, who has returned home after the war to visit. He sees the film. He's quite struck by it. He returns back to Seattle, Washington, and shows it to a bunch of his mountaineering buddies. And in seeing the film, they are so impressed by what the Austrians are doing that they say, we have to do something similar. We have to have a really well-organized mountain rescue committee, which they form, the Seattle Mountain Rescue Committee. And that committee then becomes the nucleus of what later is formed, just a few years later, the Mountain Rescue Association. The Mountain Rescue Association is the umbrella organization for all mountain rescue activity in the United States. And that organization has deep awareness of its Austrian roots. When it was formed, many Austrians came to consult with the leaders of the organization about how to accomplish their rescues best. The honor guard of the Mountain Rescue Association, which presides, for instance, over various ceremonial activities that the organization might undertake, like, say, funerals for members, including those who have passed away tragically in the course of rescue, they have a symbol that they carry, namely an ice axe from Austria. So they carry an Austrian ice axe centrally to their identity of the organization. And then there's a very interesting episode where there's a great mountain rescue physician in Austria known as Vastl Mariner. And in 1948, he published a very important textbook of mountain rescue called Neuzeitliche Bergrettungstechnik. And that was a book that was known in the United States to quite a number of mountaineers who spoke German, either because they were from Germany or Austria or Switzerland in some cases, or because they learned it, because they knew how important those regions were to mountaineering, but not to those who spoke only English. And beginning in 1961, a couple of mountaineers and mountain rescue members, leaders, again in Seattle, Washington, one named Dr. Otto Trott, originally from Berlin, but a man who spent very important childhood vacations in Berchtesgaden and who also had some student Zeit in Innsbruck, and another from Vienna named Kurt Beam, joined together with the Alpenverein in Innsbruck to translate that book into English. And in 1963, it appeared as Mountain Rescue Techniques. It became the standard book of mountain rescue in the United States, and it was adopted by the International Committee on Alpine Rescue as its standard text in the English edition. So there's just this really direct influence. There's a bridge, basically, from Innsbruck to Seattle. It runs nice and straight. Interestingly, now, the influence is happening in reverse. Oh, here's another interesting, I could talk about this forever. Here's another interesting symbol of that influence. The Mountain Rescue Association, which is, again, an American association in Seattle, Washington, it had a newsletter beginning in the 1950s, and the name of the newsletter was Bergtrage. So there's a German name for the newsletter of the American Association. It shows the depth of influence. Now the influence is happening sort of in reverse. American mountain rescue techniques, technology, and thinking has come to influence Austria. And today, for instance, there's a developing approach to wilderness medicine in Austria called tactical alpine medicine. Tactical alpine medicine basically incorporates into medical practices in the mountains various lessons learned by the American military in various operations over the last couple of decades, for instance, in Mogadishu, about how to treat the injured, and was then institutionalized in a program called Tactical Combat Casualty Care. So tactical combat casualty care has come to influence Austrian mountain rescue through the principle of tactical alpine medicine. So there's a very nice and very direct back and forth between the countries.
That's very interesting. Here, I want to bring in the question or the aspect. Would you say that American Rescue Service is also influencing how the Bergrettung operates in regards how to handle different cultures or how to deal with people who are not from the Alps? Because you mentioned in a previous conversation that most of the people rescued by the Bergrettung, by the local people, are tourists. And that also brings in cultural challenges when doing so. So one would be a percentage of tourists being treated, and also if the cultural difference is something we might have to learn new techniques.
Yes.
Maybe you want to talk about this a little bit as well.
Sure, yeah. I think that's an interesting part. Those are two questions, but I think I could answer three questions, including one that's implicit in what you say. Let's see what happens. I would say first, it's important to bear in mind that there's a major difference between the Mountain Rescue Service in Austria and in the United States, in that the service in Austria is just so much bigger, so much more pervasive. It plays such a greater cultural role. It's just much more important socially. We have, of course, mountain rescue associations all over the country, and they're very important where they are. And they do extraordinary, heroic work, not only the private institutions, but also the rescues that happen under the auspices of the National Park Service. But it's nowhere near as grand, systematic, organized as it is in Austria. It's also just a much bigger country. So I think that it's very difficult to compare the cultural role. To me, one of the interesting features of the Mountain Rescue Service in Austria is that, as you say, most of the people who are rescued today are not simply tourists, they are foreigners. In Tyrol, for instance, where about one third of the about 12,000 members of the Rescue Service work, or volunteer, I should say, 75% of the people rescued are from outside of Austria. Many of those are German, but many and increasing numbers come from all over Europe and, of course, beyond Europe. And that is an aspect of the service, and I think a developing aspect of the service that really interests me. Austria, as you know, is a country that whose economic lifeblood depends on tourism. And I think what will be interesting to observe in the future is whether the increasing presence of tourists well outside the German-speaking world in Austria places a certain pressure on the Bergrettung. I don't think that the pressure will necessarily come from the fact that many of those tourists will be from the quite far abroad, China, for instance, East Asia. Though that's something interesting to think about. And it certainly was the centerpiece of my investigations in Sweden. Instead, I think what you'll see is the number of rescues in Austria are simply going to increase in future years as more tourists come and are essentially encouraged to take risks beyond their abilities in the mountains, and may be encouraged to take those risks in part precisely because they know that there's an institution out there which will rescue them if they get into trouble. And that will be significant if that continues to happen and if the number of rescues in the mountains continues to increase. Pressure will be put, this is the third question that you didn't ask, but I think is implicit in what you said, pressure will be put on a central aspect of the organizational identity of the service, namely that it is entirely voluntary. Not all rescue organizations are voluntary associations, right? France, mountain rescues are all done by the gendarmes, for instance. In the United States, there are private associations modeled on those in Austria that are purely voluntary, but there's also the National Park Service. Many different ways to organize a mountain rescue service. In Austria, the organization is regional and local and be voluntary. And I think, as we suggested earlier in our conversation, volunteering for the Mountain Rescue Service, it's not like volunteering to make cookies. I love cookies. It's really dangerous. So I think this is sort of the nub, the central point of interest for me about the institution. Where does that sense of voluntary commitment come from? And in talking with a lot of the Mountain Rescue members, drinking a lot of beer and schnapps with them especially, what really comes to the fore is that a voluntary commitment to this altruistic activity in which members are willing to risk their lives to save not only others, but in general, people from abroad, it doesn't come from an abstract commitment to the human good. But instead, it comes from a commitment to and love of a particular place, a village or a valley or a set of mountains. The energy to rescue comes from the local. Maybe I could explain that a little bit more, because it's really something that drives my interest. The rescue service, first, isn't so much a national organization, right? It's a regional and local one because it is centered. First, it's not organized nationally. It's organized regionally by state. But the energy comes from the Ortsstellen, that is the mountain huts that the members of the organizations build and maintain. And those members are, in some sense, you could say, village boys. It's not a term that I use at all pejoratively, but rather positive. They're village boys. They've grown up together. They know each other. Their fathers were often in the organization, very much like, say, the voluntary fire service, Freiwillige Feuerwehr, or the voluntary ambulance services here in the United States. They drink beer together. They join the rescue service because of their buddies, because of their Kumpels. And in that sense, they're localists. If we can speak of there being a social truth of the Bergrettung, it lies in a way not so much in rescue, but in the sale of mulled wine at the Christmas market stand or the raising of the maypole. So members are really rooted in their local communities. And so the solidarity of the organization or the solidarity that it expresses, including solidarity with foreign tourists, and its kind of transnational or even universalistic commitments, they grow from energies that you could call those of local self-governance and territorial consciousness. And I think that has much broader implications for liberal political theory, liberal politics, that kind of thing.
Yes, since we can't go into all of this, which would be very interesting, but I want to come back to this one question which you mentioned in the beginning. What does the Bergrettung teach us about democracy. So you just mentioned this being rooted in the local and then also having this universal concern about humans. How can we transfer some of the insights you got from that to democracy? I think that's also what drives you, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In thinking not only about the Beggar Hetong, but the emergency medical services generally, but I think the Mountain Rescue Service really shows some of the social and cultural dynamics that have implications for political theory and critical cultural studies, you could say, in the clearest light. Here are two things that occur to me in reaction to your question. One concerns the everyday practices of the Mountain Rescue Service, and the other concerns its organization and these local energies that we just talked about. One of the things that the Rescue Service teaches the young men who are a part of its organization is to pay extraordinary attention to other people, that is the patients, the people who are in need of rescue, to treat their injuries and to write down their medical issues in a report. That is, in a way, to narrativize, to put it in kind of jargony terms, to narrativize their experience of a narrative that's then used by higher medical authorities to treat them. So it's interesting to me that the Mountain Rescue Service is an institution that trains people, volunteers, call them just average citizens, to observe and to write about others, not themselves. And that's quite contrary to a lot of, I think, contemporary education. The Mountain Rescue Service is, in that sense, countercultural. And it expresses, I think, a fundamental, call it mountain ethics, from which people in the flatlands can learn. But more deeply on the question of the local, here's what I think one might say. One can build a political theory from the top down, from the abstract into the particular. I'm interested, in a way, in doing the opposite. That is, in using ethnography, a kind of ethnography, to build up into larger theoretical concepts. And in thinking about, to think about politics through the Mountain Rescue Service.
Yes, and I want to narrow down the concept politics, maybe because it's a podcast for Scientists for Future, narrow it down to, you know, politics in regards to environmental issues. And
Yeah, very good. So here's what I think you can say generally in response to observing the Berg question. Liberal political theory and liberal politics, the kind of liberal theorizing that developed especially in the wake of the Second World War, needs to do more to fully account for a sense of place, for a sense of the local. And here we could say something that even might be rather controversial, especially in Germany. And I appreciate that it's controversial. I think we can ask whether we liberals learned some incorrect lessons from World War II with regard to the importance of place and local attachments. And this will relate very much to environmentalism, I hope. There's been a really strong and understandable reaction against romanticism and nationalism and all the rest in our abstract conceptualization of rights and our tendency to dissolve sovereignty in the realm of both ideas and institutions. But that may have made liberalism blind to essential parts of the human condition and therefore unstable in the long term. And maybe thinking about the success of the Berg Retreat can help remedy that. Now, here are some examples of some problems that a lack of thinking about the local, I think, has led liberal theorizing. Take the American failure in Afghanistan recently, right, internationally. The American failure in Afghanistan comes in part, at least, I think you could say reasonably, from a failure to understand the nature of the society as a society of mountains and valleys, right? A very particularized consciousness. And in this sense, Austria is Afghanistan. Austria is like Afghanistan. There's a particularistic consciousness that grows from valleys surrounded by mountains. So we can learn things from institutions of the mountains. And something similar has happened.
So I just have to clarify this. You're not saying Austria is Afghanistan. A lot of people might like this, especially Austrians. But you're just saying that, you know, both countries have beautiful mountains. Both countries have communities in the mountains that are very attached to the localities. Yep. And they very much operate limited in the mountains, so you don't get far in the mountains, right? Exactly. On that sense, I mean, we sometimes forget that Afghanistan is more than war, that Afghanistan, I had a few friends in Afghanistan and they always kept talking about the mountains and how beautiful them are, and especially the guys, how much they liked exploring them. Exactly. So I totally see your point, yes. That's why I really connected with my friends from Afghanistan, because we love to talk about the mountains, yes.
Well, that's fantastic. Yeah, that's exactly what I mean. Here would be one sort of extreme way, exaggerated way of putting it. The thing that contributed to the American failure in Afghanistan, namely a failure to understand a culture and a society of mountains and valleys, is something that we can learn from. It's something that we can remedy. That is, we can remedy that failure of understanding in Afghanistan by thinking about Austria and by thinking about the Mountain Rescue Service in Austria and where its solidaristic voluntary commitments come from. And to the extent that the failure in Afghanistan arises from the deficiencies in liberal political thought and practice, in that it fails sufficiently to account for particularistic local attachments, something similar could be said, I think, in regards to environmental protection. We can link these different tendencies toward either military failure, economic degradation, as in some of the forgotten places in the United States or Europe, and environmental degradation. These may all be the consequence of a insufficiently theorized sense of place within liberal political theory. And we can use, I think, the Bergrettung in Austria to help us think through some of those issues.
So would you say that the concept Heimat, which often has kind of, you know, negative connotations, very often it's dragged into right-wing discourse, that it really needs to have new connotation, it needs new discourse that kind of promotes the positive aspects of a sense of place and doesn't put it into the conservative corner that easily, as it happens quite often?
Yeah, precisely. Precisely so. I mean, I'm really conscious of that whole discourse of someone making a film about mountains in Austria. Obviously, mountains had an incredibly important role to play in the ideology of Nazism. The cinematic tradition of the mountain film from Frank and Riefenstahl and the whole rest of the crew forward is really important in that ideology. In some sense, the ideology was repackaged in the Heimat film after the war. And as you say, that discourse is unfortunately really associated with the right often. And as someone who's not on the right, I think we should take its energies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm a liberal. But we need to confront the energy of anti-liberal critiques of liberalism so that we can make liberalism better. And the criticism of liberalism's sense of place and particularity, and ultimately of culture, is one of those. And I hope that thinking about the medical rescue activities that happen in the mountains in Austria provides a framework through which to think about that, precisely because the Bergrettung is central to Austria's identity as a highly successful liberal society.
Yes, I just want to mention quickly, I grew up in the Alps and had friends who were active in the Bergrettung. And now hearing your perspective of this, I find it quite interesting because they or I never saw them as heroes. It was just something they did. You know, it's such a normal part of our Alpine culture that it's just something people do because, you know, like I do something else. It's so much part of everyday life that they sometimes talk about it, but they don't really, you know, make a big story about it. So it's quite fascinating.
Yes.
And in regards to the more nuanced aspect of the concept of Heimat, I want to mention two people here. One is Lawrence Buell from Harvard University, who wrote about sense of place quite a lot. And he also pointed out that there is a difference in perception, especially him being American, between Germany and the United States, also, as you mentioned already, because of the World War and how it impacted people's thinking about Blut und Boden. And then there's Ursula Heise, who wrote a book called Sense of Place, Sense of Planet, where she kind of questions this approach to sense of place. And I once had a discussion with her, and she was like, well, what's sense of place anyway? Mm. And I was quite surprised. And to me, it felt like asking, what is love anyway? You know, how do you explain love if you, you know?
This is a wonderful analogy, not a wonderful parallel. Absolutely. Yeah. Because here's what you could say. How about this one? Love is the basis for a political community. Love of people in a particular place.
Yes.
And so I think this connection between sense of place, love, something inexplicable, powerful, and ever present, and politics is, it's almost inseparable. Sense of place, sense of love, sense of political community, self-governance, local self-governance. Yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
I think this is a beautiful way to end this podcast. Thank you so much. There are lots of inspirational thoughts, and I'm looking forward to your film. I think it's going to be very, very inspirational, especially also to the environmental humanities community. I'm going to recommend it to people in that community. And I wish you amazing times while filming in Austria, in the Alps. Have great fun with the Bergrettung people.
Vielen Dank, vielen Dank. Und ja, das war eine richtige Freude.
Gleichfalls.
Und ich schicke schöne Grüße an alle die Mitglieder der Alpenverein, entweder in Deutschland oder Österreich oder überall in der Welt. Viel Freude in the outdoors. In the mountains. It was a real pleasure talking.
Thank you so much, Mark.